We actually know how to build a star on Earth. Like, that is not the problem anymore.
Right. Yeah. The physics of it, sparking nuclear fusion, you know, getting those incredibly hot isotopes to smash together. We've kind of figured that out.
Yeah, humanity has achieved that. But the reason fusion power feels like this perpetual horizon that we just can't quite reach is that we have absolutely no idea what to build the cage out of.
Exactly. I mean, it is the ultimate engineering paradox. We're trying to harness this virtually inexhaustible zero carbon power supply, right? Mm-hmm. But to do that, we have to subject physical materials to an environment so completely hostile that it fundamentally redefines how we even understand material science.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because our mission for today's deep dive is to explore the most extreme engineering environment ever conceived. We're talking about the first wall of a commercial fusion reactor.
Yeah, the literal front lines.
Right. And we are taking you straight into the microscopic atomic level battles happening inside the metals that are, well, just trying to survive in there. So if you picture a fusion reactor, it's basically like trying to hold a miniature sun inside a giant thermos.
That's a good way to look at it, yeah.
And the magnetic fields are doing their job, right? They're containing that 100 million degree plasma so it doesn't touch the sides. But if the plasma isn't touching the thermos, what exactly is hitting the walls that makes this such a nightmare scenario?
Well, what's fascinating here is that the culprit isn't the charged plasma itself. In a commercial magnetic confinement plant, your fuel is this mix of hot deuterium and tritium.
Okay.
And when those atomic nuclei fuse together, they produce two things. Alpha particles, which are essentially just helium ions, and then these extremely energetic neutrons.
And those behave differently, right?
Totally differently. Mm-hmm. Because the alpha particles have an electrical charge, the magnetic fields are, you know, highly effective at trapping them inside the plasma. It keeps everything hot. Mm. But those neutrons, they carry zero electrical charge.
Oh, so the magnets don't even see them.
Exactly. The magnetic fields are completely invisible to them. So they just fly straight out of the plasma and smash relentlessly right into the surrounding first wall material.
And, I mean, these aren't just your run-of-the-mill neutrons either. The data we're looking at shows they have a characteristic energy peak around 14 mega electron volts, or MeV.
Yeah, 14 MeV.
Which I think we need a baseline for that for everyone listening, because 14 MeV just sounds like abstract math. How does that actually compare to what we normally deal with?
So to put in perspective, a standard medical X-ray might expose you to about 0.1 MeV of energy.
Okay, 0.1.
Right. And if we look at a traditional nuclear fission power plant like the ones running all over the world today, mm-hmm. the neutrons bouncing around inside those reactors average roughly 1 to 2 MeV.
Wow. Okay, so fusion is throwing 14 MeV neutrons at the wall.
Yeah. It is a massive, massive leap in kinetic energy.
So we've got these 14 MeV neutrons just bombarding the structural walls. And before we even get into how that alters the chemistry, we really need to look at the physical chaos this causes at the atomic level. Because reading this, it sounds like a microscopic wrecking ball.
Oh, it really is. The aftermath of that impact is staggering. When a 14 MeV neutron slams into the first wall, it directly strikes the atomic nuclei of the metal itself.
Just the direct hit.
A direct hit. And that first atom it hits absorbs a massive amount of kinetic energy and recoils, violently smashing into its neighboring atoms.
Which then hit other atoms.
Right. Those neighbors recoil and hit others, cascading outward in this chain reaction that physicists call a collision cascade.
It's like the world's most destructive break in a game of pool.
Yeah, exactly. And the physical result of that microscopic break is twofold. You end up with a central core where, well, a bunch of atoms used to be. It leaves these empty microscopic holes in the metal called vacancies.
Okay, so literal holes.
Yep. And surrounding that empty core is a dense cloud of the displaced atoms, which have been violently jammed into the really tight spaces between the regular crystal lattice.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, we call those self-interstitial atoms.
Okay, but when you look at the engineering specs, the numbers on this damage are just mind-blowing. The research indicates that over a 5-year design life of a typical first wall component, the material will experience up to 200 DEPA.
Displacements per atom, yeah.
Wait, I have to pause right here. Wait. If every single atom in that steel wall is violently knocked out of its designated position 200 times over 5 years, how does the wall even exist?
It seems impossible, right?
Yeah, why doesn't it just instantly crumble into, like, metallic dust?
Well, it comes down to the fundamental nature of metallic crystal lattices. They desperately want to remain in a highly ordered state. So most of these point defects, the empty vacancies and the displaced atoms, they actually rapidly find each other and annihilate.
Annihilate, like they cancel out.
Exactly. The displaced atom is wandering through the lattice, finds an empty hole, and just pops right back into place.
Oh, wow.
It's a constant, furious process of self-healing at the atomic level.
So the metal is basically repairing itself in real time.
It is, but, you know, it's not perfect. The atoms that don't manage to find a vacancy and annihilate, they begin to migrate through the metal. And they coalesce into these extended, tangled structures, like dislocation loops.
So over a 5-year period, the wall might look perfectly fine and structurally solid to the naked eye?
But inside, yeah. Its internal architecture being completely rewritten.
That is wild. But okay, if the physical structure is getting pummeled that badly, what is happening to the actual chemical makeup of the metal?
Because you said these neutrons are uncharged, so they don't just bounce around like billiard balls. They actually enter the atomic nuclei they hit, right?
They do. And this triggers a process known as activation. When a high-energy neutron is absorbed by a stable nucleus in the steel, it fundamentally changes the atom.
It makes it radioactive. Yeah, it creates an unstable radioactive isotope. Or sometimes the sheer energy of the impact can cause the atom to eject other particles entirely. That's a process called transmutation.
So suddenly, the perfectly stable steel you use to construct your clean energy reactor is fiercely radioactive.
Exactly.
Which, as we saw in the sources, creates a massive headache for what happens at the end of the reactor's life. Like, for anyone wondering why we don't just use standard commercial steel, the kind we use in bridges or ships, it all comes down to the waste.
Oh, 100%.
Because the design codes for fusion structural steels strictly require them to meet the U.S. Department of Energy Class C waste conditions, which means the radioactivity has to decay to safe, manageable levels within 100 to 500 years.
And achieving that 500-year decay limit, it essentially means throwing out decades of metallurgical knowledge.
How so?
Well, traditional heavy-duty steels rely on specific alloying elements, like molybdenum, nickel, and niobium. That's what gives them their immense strength and heat resistance.
Yeah.
The problem is that in a fusion environment, those specific elements transmute into long-lived radionuclides. If they are present in the steel, the reactor wall will remain dangerously radioactive for tens of thousands of years.
So you just can't use them, which means engineers are having to invent completely new metals from scratch.
Yeah, they call them RAFM steels. Reduced Activation Ferritic Martensitic Steels.
Right, and the purity requirements for these are just absurd. I was thinking about it like this. Imagine a massive, multi-million gallon town reservoir of pristine drinking water, right?
I'm with you.
If even a single drop of a specific industrial chemical gets into that reservoir, the entire town's water supply is condemned for centuries. That is essentially what engineers are dealing with when it comes to niobium in these steels.
That's a really good analogy.
The maximum permitted concentration for niobium in these reactor walls is less than 3 weight parts per million. 3 parts per million.
It's incredibly strict. But, you know, when you scale back and look at the fundamental purpose of fusion technology, you understand why those regulations exist. The entire promise of fusion is a clean, sustainable energy future for everyone.
Right. Clean energy.
But if we generate limitless electricity and in the process turn the reactor walls into long-lived radioactive waste that requires, you know, specialized underground storage for 20,000 years, we have just reinvented the exact problem we currently face with nuclear fission.
We haven't actually solved anything.
Exactly. And that's why material scientists are being forced to substitute those traditional strengtheners with elements like chromium, tungsten, and vanadium.
Because those elements don't produce the long-lived radioactive waste.
Exactly that. They have very high, or in some cases, absolutely no maximum concentration limits. They can absorb those 14 MeV neutrons and still decay relatively quickly.
Okay, so we strip out the bad elements, like niobium and molybdenum, and we bring in chromium and tungsten to keep the steel clean. But that introduces a whole new set of problems, doesn't it?
Oh, big time.
Because we still have to face what the radiation does to the mechanical integrity of this newly engineered RAFM steel over time. The research shows the radiation attacks the metal in 3 completely different catastrophic ways.
Yeah, it's a multi-front war. The first major mode of failure is swelling. So earlier we talked about transmutation, the neutrons actually changing the elements inside the steel.
Right.
Well, one of the most common byproducts of those nuclear reactions is helium. The radiation produces up to 2,000 atomic parts per million of helium inside the solid steel.
Inside the metal, which is a huge problem because helium doesn't want to bond with anything.
No, it is completely insoluble in steel. Being a noble gas, it just doesn't form chemical bonds with the iron lattice.
Mm.
So The helium atoms migrate through the solid metal until they find those empty microscopic vacancies, the holes left behind by the collision cascades.
So they just fill up the holes.
Yeah, the helium fills them up, creating these highly pressurized microscopic gas bubbles or voids.
And when you have billions of pressurized gas bubbles forming inside a solid piece of metal, the actual physical dimensions of the metal start to expand.
Visibly expand, yes.
The data indicates the material can swell by tens of percent. Like, if your reactor wall, which is precision engineered to contain 100 million degree plasma, suddenly grows and distorts by 10%, that is a catastrophic engineering failure. The thermos basically buckles.
It does. And that swelling leads right into the second failure mode, which is hardening. So those dislocation loops we talked about, the tangled messes of displaced atoms that didn't heal properly, they act like physical barricades inside the metal lattice.
Right, the traffic jams.
Yeah. In a normal piece of steel, when you put stress on it, the crystal layers can slide past each other just a little bit. That's what gives metal its toughness, its ability to bend without breaking.
Makes sense.
But with all these radiation-induced barricades in the way, the atomic layers can't move. The metal becomes significantly harder, but also far more rigid.
Which brings us to the third failure mode. And this one sounds terrifying. I saw a term heavily referenced in the research. DBTT, or the ductile to brittle transition temperature.
Right, the DBTT shift.
It sounded like they were testing the exact temperature at which the steel stops bending under pressure and essentially starts shattering like a pane of glass. But how do you even test something like that in an irradiated environment?
So they use something called a Charpie V-notch impact test. You basically take a standardized rectangular bar of the metal. You machine a V-shaped notch into one side to concentrate the stress, and then you strike it with a heavy swinging pendulum.
Just smash it.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And by measuring how much energy the pendulum loses when it breaks the metal, you can determine exactly how brittle the material has become. As the metal gets irradiated, that transition temperature, the point where it shatters instead of bending, it shifts higher and higher.
Meaning it could spontaneously shatter at normal operating temperatures?
Exactly.
See, I understand the mechanics of the pendulum test, but here's where I have a major pushback on the testing methodology we read about. Because of the space constraints inside modern radiation testing facilities, the research notes they are miniaturizing these Charpie test specimens down to 3.3 by 3.3 millimeter.
Yeah, they are very small.
That is basically the size of a matchstick. Can we really trust a test done on a piece of radioactive metal the size of a matchstick to guarantee the structural safety of a massive commercial power plant?
I mean, it is one of the most heavily debated topics in nuclear material science today. What you're pinpointing are known as specimen size effects.
Yeah.
Because fracture mechanics change fundamentally when you scale down.
Right.
A tiny matchstick of steel might shear or shatter entirely differently than a massive structural plate under the exact same temperature conditions.
So how on earth do they compensate for that?
Well, engineers rely on complex statistical models called master curves. The assumption is that there is a universal curve shape for how this specific type of cleavage fracture behaves across different temperatures. So they take the data from the matchstick, find where it sits on the curve, and then index the entire curve to predict how a massive plate would behave.
But is it accurate?
Honestly, if you look at the raw data, there is a tremendous amount of scatter. The uncertainty in these models is highly acknowledged by the engineers. It's an imperfect science born of pure necessity.
Wow. Okay, so scientists know the precise, almost agonizing ways the metal tries to swell with helium bubbles, harden with atomic barricades, and shatter into glass. But they haven't just thrown up their hands.
No. Definitely not.
Because they've actually developed several leading supermaterial candidates designed specifically to counter these effects.
Yeah, there are three main contenders vying to be the material of the future. The first is vanadium alloys.
Okay, vanadium.
They are incredibly attractive from a waste perspective because they have naturally low activation characteristics, and they maintain excellent structural strength up to about 700 degrees Celsius.
That sounds perfect.
It does. But they have a very shallow experimental database compared to steel. Furthermore, if the ratio of chromium in the vanadium alloy is off by even a small margin, the metal becomes highly susceptible to that radiation embrittlement we just talked about.
So it's risky. Then you have what looks like the sci-fi dream material on paper. Silicon carbide composites, specifically SiCFSi.
Yeah, from a thermal efficiency standpoint, silicon carbide is the holy grail. It can maintain its structural integrity at temperatures well over 1,000 degrees Celsius, which would massively increase the electrical output of the power plant.
Right. Hotter means more power.
Exactly. Plus, it experiences very little void swelling and has excellent low activation properties. But the engineering roadblocks are severe.
There's always a catch.
Always. Under high neutron irradiation, it produces far too much transmutation gas. And more importantly, from a practical construction standpoint, it is nearly impossible to weld or join silicon carbide plates together hermetically.
And you need complex shapes for a reactor vessel.
Right. You can't build a reactor if you can't seal the pieces together.
Which brings us to what seem to be the near-term heroes of the group. ODS alloys. Oxide dispersion strengthened alloys.
Yes, the ODS alloys.
So this is essentially a RAFM steel matrix, but it's peppered with ultrafine particles of titanium, yttrium, and oxygen. And these particles are roughly 2 nanometers in diameter. Wait,
right.
How do you even get a 2-nanometer particle evenly distributed inside a solid block of steel in the first place? You can't just stir them into a vat of liquid metal, right?
No, you really can't, because they would just clump together or float to the top. They use a technique called mechanical alloying, which is a form of powder metallurgy.
Powder? Like metal dust?
Yeah. You take the steel in a fine powder form and the yttrium, titanium, oxygen particles, and you put them in a high-energy ball mill. Heavy steel balls violently smash the powders together for hours or even days, physically embedding the nanoparticles into the steel grains.
Wow.
Then you take that composite powder and bake it under immense pressure until it fuses into a solid block.
That sounds incredibly labor-intensive.
Oh, it is.
But the reason they do it is fascinating. I was thinking about it like this. If you picture the solid metal, it's like they have distributed billions of microscopic sponges throughout the steel.
That's a great visual.
Because these 2-nanometer particles act as traps. When the radiation generates that insoluble helium gas, the gas migrates until it hits one of these yttrium oxide particles. The particle captures the helium and holds it tight, locking it in place before the gas can pool together at the weak grain boundaries and crack the steel wide open.
It is an absolutely brilliant microstructural solution to the helium swelling problem. The particles force the helium to form billions of tiny, harmless bubbles rather than a few massive structure-destroying voids.
Amazing.
And, you know, as with all things in extreme engineering, there is a severe trade-off. ODS alloys trap helium beautifully, but their complex powder-forged microstructure makes them exceptionally difficult to manufacture at scale, and even harder to weld.
Ah, because welding melts metal.
Exactly. If you try to weld 2 heavy plates of ODS steel together, the intense heat of the weld melts the steel matrix. And the moment it turns liquid, those carefully distributed 2-nanometer particles are free to move.
So they just clump up.
Yeah, they clump together into large, useless blobs. The weld joint loses the perfect dispersion of nanoparticles, meaning the joint itself loses the ability to trap helium. You literally destroy the very benefit you engineered into the metal.
It feels like for every step forward, the physics of the universe pushes back twice as hard.
It really does.
And that brings us to the ultimate catch-22 of fusion energy. We have these incredible candidate materials, the highly purified RAFM steels, the nanoparticle-packed ODS alloys. But to know if they will actually survive 200 displacements per atom and 2,000 parts per million of helium over 5 years, we need a working fusion reactor to test them in. But we cannot build a commercial fusion reactor until we know which materials actually work. How do you break a loop like that?
It's tough. You have to lean heavily on advanced computation and specialized, highly targeted testing facilities. This is where AI, specifically Bayesian artificial neural networks, and a planned facility called IFNIF, the International Fusion Materials Irradiation Facility, come into play.
Okay, IFF.
Right, because right now our experimental database for irradiated metals comes almost entirely from fission reactors. But as we discussed, that is low flux, low energy data. The neutrons just aren't hitting hard enough.
Right, 1 or 2 MeV instead of 14.
Exactly. So scientists train these neural networks on the existing fission data to predict how the materials will behave when they finally face the 14 MeV fusion regime.
But wait, if we have these powerful neural networks that can map the microstructures and predict things like the exact temperature shift where the metal turns to glass, why do we need to spend billions of dollars building physical testing facilities? Can't the AI just run the simulation and tell the engineers what to build?
Well, this raises an important question. It gets right to the heart of the limits of artificial intelligence in the physical sciences. The reason engineers use Bayesian neural networks isn't just because they're good at guessing. It's because they provide a mathematical measure of their own uncertainty.
Oh, like a confidence score.
Exactly. A standard AI might confidently spit out a totally wrong answer. A Bayesian network outputs a prediction alongside a confidence interval. When scientists feed these models data and ask them to predict damage levels above 100 dpa, the error bars completely explode.
So the AI is essentially looking at the 14 MeV fusion regime and saying, I have no idea.
The AI is literally screaming that the underlying physical data required to make a safe prediction simply does not exist. It is warning the engineers not to trust the extrapolations. Because, I mean, you cannot build a multi-billion dollar power plant on a pure extrapolation.
Which means physical data is non-negotiable.
Absolutely.
Which is why this new facility, IFEMIF, is so essential. And from what the sources describe, instead of trying to build an incredibly complex burning plasma reactor just to test metals, IFEMIF takes a different approach. It uses two massive linear accelerators to shoot highly energetic deuterons at 40 MeV into a flowing waterfall of liquid lithium.
Yeah, liquid lithium.
And when the deuterons hit the lithium, it strips off high-energy neutrons that perfectly mimic the 14 MeV spectrum of a real fusion star. So you get the fusion-level wrecking balls without needing the fusion reactor.
It is an incredibly ingenious workaround. It provides the exact neutron spectrum needed to blast the test metals and see how they actually hold up. But it comes with a massive logistical bottleneck that grounds the entire process.
Always a bottleneck.
The available HyFlex testing volume, like the actual physical space inside IFEMIF where you can place these metal samples to get the highest level of radiation, is incredibly tiny.
How tiny are we talking?
It is about 0.5 liters.
Half a liter. That is the size of a standard disposable water bottle.
Yes. Half a liter of volume for the entire international fusion community to test their leading alloys. And to run a single experiment up to that crucial 150 dpa threshold, you know, to simulate a commercial reactor's lifespan, it takes 5 straight years of continuous irradiation.
5 years to test a water bottle's worth of metal. Wow. It really puts that old joke about fusion always being decades away into a harsh, highly practical perspective.
It really is.
While the giant superconducting magnets and the 100 million degree plasma get all the media glory, the true unsung heroes of the clean energy revolution are the material scientists. They are the ones agonizing over how to evenly distribute 2 nanometer yttrium particles, wrestling with 3 parts per million niobium contamination limits, and, you know, trying to figure out how to weld a metal without destroying its microscopic architecture. So what does this all mean for you? The next time you read a headline about a breakthrough in fusion plasma containment, you will know that is really only half the story. The real finish line isn't just sparking the star, it is building the cage that can hold it.
And that leaves us with one final thought to ponder regarding the future of this technology. Consider the sheer timescales of human innovation at play here. The international community is actively racing to deploy commercial fusion power plants, often referred to as demo plants, by the 2040s.
Right, to stave off the worst effects of global warming.
Exactly. Yet, as we just discussed, it takes a minimum of 5 years just to irradiate a single half-liter batch of test metals. And that's not even counting the time it takes to analyze the results and develop the next iteration. So, are our traditional methodical testing pipelines fast enough to meet the urgent climate deadlines of the 21st century? Or will mastering the material science of tomorrow require a fundamentally new way of doing science itself?
A race against time to build a thermos for a star half a liter at a time. We'll leave you with that thought. Keep learning, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.